Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. I'm completely surrounded by my stuff. I can hardly move. Wouldn't it be good if all this stuff was able to be stored electronically in some way and I'd be able to plug into it and search for things? Ah well, let's leave that to the boffins. Until then, here on my right is the great library of RPGs and my Grognard Files. Here on my left is the ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Munro. I'll just give it a tap. Ah yes, this time the Eternal Champion is appearing as an unnamed bar worker in a short film, End User, a warning about the perils of new technology. Phones don't kill people, people do. Last time we looked at the home computer, specifically the ZX Spectrum and its role in our everyday lives back in the 1980s, and this time we're looking at the wider culture of computer technology and how it shaped our imagination, how it created a new imaginary place to play games. Cyberspace and cyberpunk were emerging as concepts in the 1980s and spawned a new genre of literary fiction, films, and a way of talking about human relationships with technology. More importantly for us, cyberspace created a new setting for gaming. In this episode, Alistair Davidson joins me in the room of role-playing rambling to add William Gibson's Neuromancer to the ever-expanding Appendix G, the list of inspirational media generated by the Grog Squad team of listeners. Cyberpunk, the RPG, was first published in 1988, created by Mike Poundsmith, and published by R. Telsorian Games. It has continued to be developed, and its timeline move on through subsequent editions. In 1990, it became Cyberpunk 2020. In 2005, it was released as version 3.0. And most recently, in 2020, it was released as Cyberpunk Red. It's also inspired a computer game, the Netrunner collectible card game, comics and novels, and a whole host of other media set in the world of Night City. If you listen regularly, you'll know that we stopped playing around 1989 and entered a deep freeze, which we only fully emerged from in 2010. We missed the array of splat books published by R. Telsorian Games in the 1990s. But we have recently played in a series of Cyberpunk Red, GM'd by our good friend Steve Rumney. And I have games mastered the introductory scenario in the Jumpstart Kit, the excellent starter pack for the game. I'm joined by our resident rules lawyer, Judge Blythe, as we reflect on the concept of cyberpunk in general. We look at some of the highlights of Cyberpunk Red from our experiences of playing. We also have a chat about Doctor Who and games within games. I'll be back at the end with some parish notices, but until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Appendix G!
Welcome to the Zoom of role-playing rambling. This is the part of the podcast where we invite a member of the Grog Squad to add to the ever-expanding list of Appendix G influences from the world of comics, films, books. Today, we've got Alistair Davidson. Hello, Alistair. Welcome to the Zoom of Roleplaying Rambling.
Hi, Dirk. Absolute pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Where in the world are you beaming from?
I'm in the still rainy northeast of England. I'm near a town called Washington, which is between Newcastle and Sunderland.
How did you get into role playing?
There was a game, got it for Christmas 1982, I think it would have been, called Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh yeah, I've heard of that.
Big purple box it was. One of the lads I went to school with, he'd been over to America and he'd played it before, and he was telling me how good it was. So as soon as I saw it was available for Christmas, I persuaded my mum and dad to buy it for me. And it was like, oh, look at this, you can do this, you can do that. And the first thing they said to me is, where's the board? And I thought, yeah, where is the board? So flicked through the rule book, and I remember in the back of it, there's a map of an old watchtower, I think it was, and it was gridded out. Me and my friend, who I ended up playing the game with, we decided we'd make a board based on that. So we got loads of old cardboard, drew the grid out, built 3D walls, and one of the shops in Sunderland, a toy shop called Joseph's, that was the first place that I ever knew sold the lead miniatures. Was it the Ralph Arthur miniatures first, and then the Citadel ones? And we got some of them. We had some old foils from Kit Kats that we scrumpled up, and we placed them in certain corners as treasures. And depending on who we were, we rolled different dice to move around this board, and we did it completely wrong for about 2 months. Then he got the expert set, and it was like, oh yeah, so there's a wilderness now. So this is what we're doing wrong. And we kind of sussed it out that one of us had to be a DM and one of us had to be a player. There was White Dwarf magazine as well. My first White Dwarf, I'm written down here, was number 38 with the Necromancer cover. He's got a decapitated head on his desk and all these candles, and there's all these runes and symbols and stuff like that. And what my parents must have thought, it's just Alice's stupid books, it'll be fine. I was hearing things from America about satanic panics and things like that, and I thought, if they get wind of this, I'll be busted. But it was just Alistair's silly books that he likes to read. A couple of years addicted to a Sinclair Spectrum after that. In the last year of school, I ended up randomly talking about Dungeons and Dragons to somebody, and he went, oh, well we play it. Why don't you come over and have a game? Nearly every day for the rest of school. So stayed on the sixth form, failed A levels obviously because I was too interested in writing character backgrounds and deciding what was going to happen next. I always loved reading. I always loved the escape of reading, but this was almost like, well, it was being a character in a story, but with a lot of other people as well and interacting with them. And the summer after O levels, Ghostbusters role-playing game was out, the West End Games one. And I think we pretty much played that nearly every weekday for the entire summer holidays.
Really?
And we got friends' sisters would end up playing in that. Oh, we need a girl to play Janine. We'll get Richie's sister in to come and do it, you know. And it was funny because everybody would be jumping in front of her character to protect that, because, oh, we've got a girl now. And it was just,
you mentioned the Spectrum there, because obviously over these episodes we're looking at computers and how role playing overlapped. So were you playing other games other than D&D and Ghostbusters, with the like science fiction stuff that you were doing as well?
I mean, at the time there was Games Workshop seemed to release a game every week, didn't they? And when Judge Dredd came out, that was the pinnacle for us, because we all read 2000 AD and would read it for us pretty much as long since it had came out. And was it Fassa who brought out Doctor Who? It was, wasn't it? Yeah. And we played we'd do an adventure, and each player would be a Time Lord for the different adventures. And our GM at the time, Larry, who GM'd absolutely everything, he bought all the games. We'd buy player handbooks. He'd buy all the adventures, and he pretty much DM'd everything that we played. We did Star Trek as well. Played Dr. McCoy in Star Trek. Wanted to be Kirk, but you know.
So did everyone.
So did everyone. Yeah, story of everybody's life, isn't it? Cyberpunk came along. One of the lads who, he was a new addition to the group, Steve, and he brought this, I think it was in a box at the time, Friday night firefight was the combat system. Kind of like the idea, it seemed like really dirty and gritty in that. Whereas, you know, you instead of just shooting perps or phases to stun and that, it was kind of like a little bit more gritty. Didn't really know what cyberpunk was. Had no idea of the genre. There was a list of books in there. Never read any of them. Never heard of any of the authors. Do you remember Max Headroom?
Oh yeah.
There was a TV series where it was about. It was called Max Headroom, 5 minutes into the future or something like that, I think it was called. Matt Frewer was in it, obviously. Amanda Pierce, who seemed to be in everything at the time. Larry basically said, oh, it's essentially set in that world. So I created a reporter called Edison Carter, very original. Something kind of grabbed me about it. Larry bought the three William Gibson books, Neuromancer, Count Zero, and Mona Lisa Overdrive. He was reading Neuromancer, so I begged and borrowed Count Zero from him. Very cleverly, I read the second book first. Once he'd finished Neuromancer, completely blew me away. I'd read nothing like it.
And you got the game before the books.
Suddenly, I was reading books, weren't based on a game, but in my head, they kind of were. In the opening of Count Zero, there's a line about a slam hound attacks the main character. And doesn't tell you what a slam hound is, other than it's something packed with explosives. So it was like, oh, well, if it's a hound, it must be a dog, and it must run into you and smack its head into you, therefore detonating the explosive. Next thing you knew, as soon as Larry had finished reading Count Zero, what do we come against in the adventure? A slam hound. He stole from the inspiration of the game that we were playing. So everything felt like it was going full circle.
So you've chosen Neuromancer to add to Appendix G,
absolutely have, yeah. Although I read Count Zero first, and Count Zero is fantastic. It's because you have these three characters and they dovetail together at the end. And it made me think you could have like three player characters play one night, one the next, and then get them all together. And it felt like it could be a gaming experience. Then reading Neuromancer from the beginning, the sky above the port is the colour of television tuned with dead channel. You can't just say the sky's grey, can he? But then...
For people who are not familiar with Neuromancer, just give us a quick overview of the book. It's quite complicated, isn't it? I've nearly completed it, but
yeah,
I've forgotten how convoluted the actual plot is. So,
I'll try then. Yeah, it's set in an 80s version of what the future will be like in, I guess, about 20 or 30 years' time from then. The protagonist, Case, is a hacker, and he's tried to swindle his previous employers, who've basically altered his insides and his brain so that he can't go into the Matrix, which is the virtual reality that the hackers kind of thrive in. And they steal from data fortresses, isn't it, where a corporation will have a fortress and they've got to kind of put electrodes on over their heads to get into the Matrix, which they see, I always saw it as like Tron, where you've got the grid across the floor and just this gray area where all these big square pixel, nothing smooth about it. These just big, great pixelated pyramids or whatever shape they are. And they go in and they have various programs that'll get them through. Case is then contacted by, I don't want to give too much away, by Armitage, and he's offered a job. It's a satellite, almost like a pleasure satellite. And he is told that if he does the job for them, God, it's hard to explain the plot, isn't it? The tinkering that's been done to him will be cured. So obviously he takes the job, but he's then told that, oh, if you don't do the job, there's poison in your blood, which is like a slow release thing, which always reminded me of Escape from New York, where Kurt Russell's character Snake Plissken's injected, isn't he? And he's got so much time to save the president. And yeah, it puts the click over, and he's partnered with Molly, who's a more or less the epitome of cool, with our mirror shades and our black leather jacket and black trousers. And she's hitman assassin kind of a character. They then have to get another guy called Riviera who can create sort of illusions and holograms and hallucinations. And Riviera insinuates himself with Tessia Ashpool, who were the family, the corporate family. Their employer, Wintermute, has told them they need to infiltrate, and Wintermute's eventual plan is to merge himself with another artificial intelligence to create what will become known as the New Romancer.
Yeah, well done.
Kind of. Phew.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned Tron, because, I mean, this was written in 1984.
Yeah.
And reading it now, I'm trying to imagine what the reference points must have been for somebody who was reading it in 1984, because subsequently it's influenced so much of popular culture, hasn't it?
Yeah.
That it's hard to see it from the point of view of somebody reading it in 1984.
Every time I've read it, I think I've read it maybe half a dozen, seven or eight times, then I always see The Matrix differently. Now it's kind of like this massively slick, almost computer game kind of thing where maybe you have an avatar that floats around and that. But back then it was Tron. And then after Tron, it became, what was the game? It was a Battlezone where everything, I think you alluded to it in the game that you did the other night, where it was like the lines.
Yeah, yeah, wireframe.
It was like, yeah, the wireframe, that's it. And
yeah.
And then I imagined it as that. And then as the computer technology's kind of grown from then, it's kind of morphed in my head to in the same way that the technology has got better.
And that's testament to Gibson's economy of style, isn't it? Because
It's
just an incredible world building.
It is, and we get a description of a girl that Case knows, a vast description of how she's got coal around her eyes, the pattern on her headband, and then on another level, you've got the cyber deck that he uses to do his hacking. It's called an Ono Sendai. You're not told what it looks like. It's a computer type thing. Does it look like your Atari console that you used to have, a VIC 20, a Sinclair Spectrum? Or is it just like, look like a laptop? I've got absolutely no idea. He'll just give you a description. Why use a sentence when two or three words will do? And you are kind of forced to fill in the blanks. It's not an easy read by any means, but once you get used to the style, I think you kind of can picture it in your head.
Yeah, and some of the imagery is quite arresting, but you realise after reading a passage of it, it's because, as you say, you filled in the blanks.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing actually inherent in what he's saying other than
not at all.
Hint or an implication.
D.D. Miles?
What are the couple of the highlights for you?
There's the scene where Case is assisted by an old hacker who died, whose personality has been essentially stored on a hard drive. They have to go and get the hard drive, and he has a connection with Molly where when he's in the Matrix, he can flip a switch. He sees what Molly sees. That whole scene where he's doing what he needs to do, and then there'll literally be a paragraph will say, Case flipped, and then suddenly it's Molly. And then he goes back and he goes backwards and forwards. What's great about it is he's done what he's done. But in the meantime, Molly's done something. There's a bit where Molly gets shot and you don't see Molly getting shot. But Case flips the switch to join her and feels her pain straight away. And that whole scene, that whole raid, I just think is absolutely fantastic. Just so well done.
That scene, I thought this feels like a familiar idea of switching identities and this transhumanism and the mutability of identity. And that kind of is very familiar to us now.
It still feels original, although it's been like the inspiration and it's been mimicked so many times. And some might say it's been mimicked better, which of course it's possible because things evolve. But for me, it still feels really, really fresh when I read it. The second one, Case walks past a bank of telephones after he's first spoken to Wintermute. And as he passes, I guess it's just a rack of payphones, isn't it? And as he walks past, each one rings, but it only rings once. I'm getting shivers up my spine talking about this. It's amazing. He walks past the phones and each one rings in time to his movement. I don't know, there's something like really eerie about that. You don't expect eeriness I don't certainly don't expect that eeriness within a science fiction novel. And it was like, oh, this is what an AI can do. And it's just making phones ring at the end of the day. But it was like, what else can it do?
Gibson was inspired by the sight of people playing games, wasn't it? And the idea that somehow they were immersed in the world, and the division between them in the physical world and the computer game world kind of breaks down. And it is that sense, isn't it, that the control of technology, who's in control, what happens to somebody's identity when technology has such presence?
Yeah. Is it Bruce Sterling who does it? Yeah, it is. It's Bruce Sterling that does the introduction in my copy, and he calls it low lives with high tech. And that's exactly right. Because none of the they're all very morally grey, the characters in this book. There isn't really a good guy, I suppose, although they're more on the side of right than wrong. And that appeals to me as well.
What was your third highlight?
Once they get into space, when I first read it, I was kind of expecting, everything's going to be shiny and Star Trek-y. And it really is. Yeah, I mean, the stray light and everything is, and they've got all casinos and fake mountain ranges and all these amazing places in this space station, if that's what Taurus, isn't it, he calls it. And everything's in there, but behind the scenes, you've got the likes of Malcolm and you know the Zionists and that, and they're just basically hard workers who are keeping everything going in the background. I love that. I mean, I love the character of Malcolm. I think he's absolutely fantastic. He's originally certainly not a character type that I've ever come across either before or since, because he just is what he is, and he makes no bones about what he is. But it was that kind of, again, even in space, where you think everybody's got an opportunity to float free doing whatever they want in a sense, it's still the lower classes and the working class doing all this for the wealthy. I mean, science fiction's renowned for having either a moral message or this is what's wrong with the world, or this is what we should be doing right with the world, and that really struck a chord with me as well.
The world's become like William Gibson's Neuromancer. Do you think how much of it is because of Neuromancer, and how much of it was Gibson's vision, and he extrapolated what he saw in 84?
I think more the latter. I think it's more Gibson taking something that was happening in the 80s, whether it be corporate greed or people wanting to look better than or look like somebody else, I guess. And he's kind of extrapolated that to what seemed at the time to be quite unbelievable. It was like the body clinics and that, where you can basically walk in somewhere and you can get your face to look like, you can get all these muscle grafts and everything. That was something I always remember when I first read that. It was like, well, who's going to wander into a shop to change their appearance? And people go to Turkey for teeth, and like you said, people can make an appointment one day and then go in and have Botox and fillers and lip injections to be how they perceive to be better looking. Yeah. I think Neuromancer still does take that to the nth degree, where people are getting pointed teeth and extra hair, so they look like wolves and things like that, like the Panther moderns do, don't they? He's not far from the truth, is he?
It's had such an impact on fiction, and I remember at the end of the 80s, start of the 90s, it kind of infused everything. You were gaming in it, and Shadowrun was part of your gaming as well, wasn't
yeah.
it? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was a huge fantasy fan in the late 80s. Suddenly there was a cyberpunk game with elves and dwarves and dragons, and then I thought, I'm having that. Probably the clunkiest system I've ever had, the GM. I don't know, it just struck a chord with myself and the people I was playing with at the time. They were coming up with, can we have a bar where we hang out? And one of the characters would turn up, and he'd say, oh, I've done the plans for the bar, and this is where our hideout is, and this is the plan for our apartment. And it just seemed to strike a chord with everybody. Netrunners are called deckers in Shadowrun. And Deccan was basically, it looked like an old flow chart, and it looked like the most uninteresting thing in the world. And guess what? It was the most uninteresting thing in the world. After that, every Deccan became an NPC. When we'd done Cyberpunk, I don't know what it was. Larry used to, he'd do the grid of the data fortress. We'd all be sat around the table, and it was when I was the Netrunner. And I always remember people who say, oh, Netrunning's really boring and Cyberpunk. And I always think of when I was the Netrunner, and Larry would say, oh, you need to get this, you need to get that. And the other players would be cheering you on, going, come on, you can do it. You can get through this. And it was a real part of the game. But then in Shadowrun, it was just like, oh, you need to roll this number. And that might be something about my skills as the GM, maybe, but it just that part of it just never thrilled me at all with Shadowrun. But all the other things with dragons, and I had a player was an elf bodyguard, and all the various supplements come out. It's like any game, isn't it? That you get so many supplements, and it makes them bigger, it makes them faster, it makes them stronger. There's guns so that can do more damage, and he'd essentially built a character that he himself thought was too powerful. I remember he gave me the sheet, and he said, "Oh, make it an NPC who will go after one of the characters if you want. Just see, he's got cyber psychosis or something." So we did that. So we had two or three adventures where the villain was the player's old character, but neither he nor any of the other players realised who it was. So I'm sat behind the screen laughing my cap off as they're trying to figure out who this person is. And I think that's why you do need a screen as well. It's not just for rolling the dice, it's so you can have a sly giggle.
Oh no, they sat in our chairs.
Neuromancer is perfect for gamers because it is a dungeon, isn't it? It's an investigation with dungeon.
It's like, it's a heist, isn't it? I suppose it's a sci-fi version of a heist.
It is funny in places as well, isn't it?
I
found that the fact that Armitage gave him an artificial pancreas on the side, and he's kind of reluctant to receive it because he can no longer get the effects of the drugs.
Yeah, it's that really, really dry wit, isn't it? And I think somebody has a line, and did you fight in World War III? And he goes, come on, World War III only lasted 6 days.
All the fetishism of the technology. You realise that it is sardonic. It's not a celebration of it. It's saying how ridiculous it is, in a sense.
It absolutely is. And nobody's life seems to be made better by it. Those who have the money seem to have more control over the technology. I mean, it's the Tessier Ashpools who have this fantastic place, the Villa Straylight. They just seem to have everything. And even though they've got everything, they kind of don't know what to do with it. It's like, oh, well, we've got this item of furniture that's 300 years old, and it kind of sits in the corner and nobody really looks at it. And
are you tempted to dust off Cyberpunk, Shadowrun, and rediscover these worlds?
I've already put a message on the Discord asking if anybody's got any Shadowrun stuff. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Alistair, for putting Neuromancer onto Appendix G.
Read and enjoy.
Judge Blythe rules.
Welcome to the Zoom of Roleplaying Rambling. I have Blythe with me. Have you got your mirror shades on, Blythe, and plugged into your deck via your neural interface?
Well, as you know, I'm that kind of guy, aren't I? That's me all over, isn't it? I struggle with any form of interface with a computer, to be fair.
You're a one-finger typist, aren't you?
One on each hand. One on each hand. You say that in a slightly mocking way. I mean, you'd be so bold. No, you're a two-finger type, one-finger typist. Like, all right, okay. Because you can do the touch typing thing, can't you?
Yeah.
You can do that, yeah. But I never learned to do that. Self-taught, two-finger typist.
It's a disadvantage as a net runner, I think. Going into the information superhighway and the matrix.
It wouldn't be though, would it? Because you wouldn't be like a one fingered net runner. You wouldn't use fingers, you'd just use your mind, wouldn't you?
Well, what's the equivalent?
Use your mind. If we were talking about that, I might be brilliant at that. You might be rubbish. You might be able to type with all your fingers, but in a neuromancer type environment, I might be brilliant. I mean, I might. Probably wouldn't be. fingers wouldn't come into it. Forget your fingers. Fish fingers.
It would be easier, wouldn't it, if we could just upload this from our heads and just put it out once a month? Because it's hard getting together, isn't it, at the moment?
It is, yeah. Yeah, work's a bit frantic, isn't it, at the moment? And for me, particularly.
People who are listening to this at the time of recording or coming from the past into the future, or however you consume this, at the moment, there is a general election being called, so you were at the coalface of democracy at the moment.
That's one way of putting it.
Anyway, have you got a drink there?
I have.
Is it a chew too? Because that's the slang for alcohol in Night City. Oh,
yeah. It is. Chew too, yeah. Simulated the pub. Simulated pub.
It's all very cosy. I was considering whether this was a bit too cosy. I don't know whether we need to inject our discussions with a bit of anger.
Yeah, I suppose if you want. What were you thinking? You're going to mention early, late Genesis or Danny Kiley. We've done that. You have to think of something new. You have to think of something new.
Well, have you been keeping up to date with the Kendrick Lamar and Drake beef?
It may surprise you to know that I don't know who either of those two people are. Are they modern popular music stars?
Yeah, it's a rap beef. Not a beef wrap.
A beef wrap. I've had one of them.
In a tortilla.
Oh, they're in Subway, yeah.
It's a bit of a throwback to the 90s. So you remember Big In Tupac?
No.
Create these diss tracks, or these diss tracks, which are songs, records, that have a go at the other. And it's a bit of a tit for tat. Lennon and McCartney did it at the beginning of the 70s, didn't they? But they didn't do it through the medium of rap.
And is it serious? Or did he mean it? Or is it just a bit of a pretend beef rather than genuine hatred, or is it genuine?
Part of it is like performative gangster bravado type mock thing that they put on. I think that's part of it. But they've got so Kendrick Lamar, he's from Compton, LA, home of hip hop, and he's a Pulitzer Prize winning rap artist who does rap about masculinity and carefully considering how celebrity impacts individuals. And then there's Drake, who's from Canada. They have a long-running rivalry, and they've been doing these. They're quite ferocious, actually. If it is mock, it is. I won't go into the details here, but the accusations that they're making are quite toe-curling. But they're really witty and creative, and I think that's what we've got to kind of tap into. I think anger is an energy, Blythe. Anger is an energy.
Well, yeah, I think the last 5 minutes there, you might want to consider the demographic of this podcast. I mean, you know, Kendrick Lamar and the other fella. Yeah. So what are you saying? You think we should kind of fall out about something? Compose songs, slagging each other off? Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm not suggesting that we pick a fight with Mike and Roger from Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice. I think we should try and keep it between us two.
Right, okay, yeah.
Because you get these podcasts, don't you, that they're quite cross with each other. And I think we should try that for a bit.
What, like get outraged about the fact you, I don't know, like one game over another or something like that?
With this topic, you know, cyberpunk, if I asked you, it's not your favourite kind of setting, is it? This kind of dark fantasy.
No, I suppose.
World.
Yeah, not really, no. From a gaming perspective, no, it's not my first choice of kind of science fiction setting, I suppose. It's not something I instinctively go for. So no, I suppose it's not.
Already you're qualifying it. Now if you wanted a proper diss and be angry, you'd say to me, no, it's rubbish, and I think you're rubbish for liking it.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, it's rubbish. Right. So I'd just say it's absolutely rubbish. And that's the end of that. They'd be absolute about it. It's rubbish, cyberpunk.
Yeah. But we'll have work on it. We'll have work on it. I'm not suggesting we do it straight away.
Well, we are going to talk about it for another 20 minutes.
Yeah.
When we've played Cyberpunk Red, haven't we? That's what we're going to talk about. And I've enjoyed it. I think it's just not quite my cup of tea from a sci-fi perspective. possibly learn from a gaming perspective, because from a literary perspective, I have a lot of time for William Gibson and all that kind of thing. I think all that kind of stuff's really good. And some of the films that have come off the back of it are good. I suppose it's that odd thing where once you drop it into a gaming environment, it leaves me a little bit cold. Compared to other sci-fi settings, it's not my kind of go-to setting. You know, I want more spaceships and stuff like that rather than grimy kind of, the mean streets of wherever, plugging into computers. So, all right.
It suits me because I think we can perhaps talk about how it emerged, because last time we talked about computers, didn't we? About our experience of personal computing. But I suppose this is the wider impact that it had on culture and how it really opened up a kind of imaginative space that didn't exist prior to cyberpunk coming into existence. It was a projection, an imaginary understanding of the interconnectivity of technology. And for me, I like those multiverses and the ability to step from one reality to another. And in a gaming space, I think that's what's appealing to me. I quite like that idea that you can have parallel existences, whether it, you know, we talked about multiverses before, whether it's in time or in space. But this is like an imaginative shared consciousness that you can step in and out of, which I find appealing from a gaming point of view.
I mean, I don't mind the idea of, you know, parallel universes. That might sound like a bit of a stick in the mud, don't I, about things like that. But I'm not entirely, I mean, we might talk about this later, but I'm not entirely convinced about the idea of going into the internet or into a network and that being this parallel universe. I think it can work, but sometimes it can turn into like a dream sequence kind of thing. That's one of the drawbacks I find. It can become like a dream sequence, which is always a bad thing in a game.
Yeah.
So that's what it can sometimes become. And as well, there's also the problem that one character's a net runner and the others are not. And so that, as you say, that kind of parallel universe idea is only really accessible to a certain type of character, isn't it? Not accessible to everybody. And that can sometimes lead to a kind of strange imbalance in the game.
Looking back to when you first heard of the idea of cyberpunk and cyberspace, when was that? Can you recall?
I suppose it was around the time of Neuromancer, reading Neuromancer. I remember reading it and kind of getting my head around the idea of it. But at the same time, it's quite a... I mean, I've not reread it since then, and it might be would be interesting to perhaps reread it and see if I kind of interpreted it differently. Although, not to say I didn't understand it when I first read it, but I think there's bits in it that are quite, sometimes perhaps were difficult to get your head around.
Definitely.
Which now seem quite commonplace. I think that's the odd thing about it. So the idea of plugging in some neural interface into a computer network and it being, as you say, like a parallel universe where you're walking around and it becomes a kind of reality, I suppose, was an odd thing. And you think of films like, remember Tron? The idea that in Tron, he gets sucked into this video game, doesn't he? But in Tron, he like literally gets sucked into it. He literally goes into it, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So Tron feels, it's a lot of fun, Tron. And I remember liking it as kids. We liked it. It's a lot of fun. But it's essentially stupid. It's a silly idea that this gamer gets sucked into the game. Like, well, what? It's not going to happen, is it? But of course, with a few years later, that is what happens. But it's a kind of very different thing, isn't it? You don't disappear into it, but your mind disappears into it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing with Neuromancer. It was that tipping point where it went from Tron type, you're in a computer. Oh, I'm stuck in a computer. Oh, I've been pulled in magically into a computer world, which is like daft, to something which is actually quite plausible. You know, it feels somehow plausible that can happen.
I wonder whether my memory of these concepts were much later than I think, because Neuromancer came out in 1983, and I didn't read it when it came out. It was quite a bit later. And I remember absorbing those books, that series with Burning Chrome, the short stories. But I wonder whether it's the bringing together of a number of different cultural phenomena at the same time that became conflated in my imagination to become what I think of as cyberspace in this cyberpunk world. Because, you know, in the late 80s, it was very much about like postmodernism, wasn't it? And the bringing together of genre, and it was more mainstream, the ideas that kick around in cyberpunk.
Yeah, I suppose, there is that.
And the impact on cinema, I mean, Blade Runner was probably a precursor to it, but the cinema that we remember being cyberpunk came through the 90s, didn't we, like Strange Days and that terrible Lawnmower Man. Do you remember that?
That's right.
And it used to be mixed up with the idea of virtual reality, and film liked the idea of making the concept of networks into something more physical and visual. I always refer to a scene in, do you remember Disclosure, the Michael Douglas sex
scam? Oh, yeah.
Demi Moore was like a sexual predator.
That's right, yeah, yeah. It was when he was doing those kind. He did a string of those kind of strange films, didn't he?
Like, yeah. And there's a sequence in it where they have to go into, they've got to hack into this data bank, and they do it as like people wondering, and it's awful. It's an awful animated sequence.
Latched on with Michael Douglas and Demi Moore.
Yeah. With a face that doesn't move, if you can imagine such a thing, with, you know, it's like a solid face like he's got now. moving through this computer network. There's a lot of instances of that where there was this idea of what cyberspace was, and people hadn't quite got the imagination.
Like you said, it kind of conflating the idea of virtual reality, the idea of going into some network mentally is not the same. It might feel virtually real, but it's not virtual reality. Virtual reality is quite a different thing. You're right. There was a lot of mixed kind of metaphors and mixed ideas about the two things. People thought they were one and the same, but they're not, are they? Because let's face it, we've got virtual reality now. You can put a virtual reality headset on, people walk around and play games with them and fall over because they've, but you can't go into a network mentally yet, can you? You can't actually disappear into it mentally. So they are different. They are different things. One's still quite sci-fi and one's got not.
We didn't have the internet, wasn't commonplace at that point, at the beginning of the 90s. It was something that was an aspirational concept that people talked about, and you had to imagine it. And I think the idea of cyberspace as defined by Gibson, and it intruded on what it actually was. It made it sound more exciting than it was. This idea that it was a new frontier that was going to open up. Yeah. And I remember a lot of the conversations around that time were about that. And of course, I think we saw Bruce Sterling, didn't we? He was promoting his book, Hacker Crackdown, which came out in the early 90s, and it was about the crackdowns that the FBI and government agencies had on hacker groups to expose them. And one of the casualties of it has a role-playing connection, because Steve Jackson Games had the cyberpunk module for GURPS seized as a potential handbook for hackers.
Really?
Yeah. It was seen as edgy and wild, and that authorities had to assert themselves on this new technology. They saw it as a form of activism, whereas it wasn't very clear that it ever was.
No, I think we both came away from that Bruce Sterling thing thinking that. And I'm not sure if he made this point, or whether it's something a conclusion we drew from some of the people there, that it was like the idea you could hack things. The idea you can hack things, you could hack government databases, you could do this, you could do that. But nobody, it didn't feel like it was a room full of activists. It just felt like it was a room full of people who decided, oh, well, we could do it, so we'll do it. It wasn't full of people who thought, well, we could change the world with this. It's a slightly, I think we both left feeling slightly depressed because we thought, oh, well, they talked about hacking, but I don't think any of those people in that room are really into using that as a force for good. It just seemed like as a force for what? Mischief, when maybe you could use it for good. But that didn't seem their point.
And I think that comes out of the fact that the literature is political because it's about these mega corporations. And we see this in the game, don't we? That these faceless corporations exerting their influence over the low life in the street. And, you know, there are protected enclaves of rich people who access the services of these corporations and others that are excluded from it. And I suppose that's where the satire comes from. I mean, I do think reading Gibson now, it is strongly satirical in the same way that J.G. Ballard used science fiction in that way to project ideas and extrapolate ideas about society and about society's relationship with technology. I remember seeing William Gibson and him saying, so somebody wanted to definition of cyberspace, and he said, cyberspace is where the bank keeps your money.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Which is a good way of putting it, isn't it? Yeah. That's where he keeps your money. It seems that it doesn't really exist. Yeah. And he wrote them on a typewriter, didn't he?
He did.
I remember that. They kind of went to the same thing. We were both at the same thing. And he said that. He said people think I write these things sat on top of an SS-20 missile or something.
Yeah.
And I use a typewriter. He said he didn't use computer. He didn't use word processor. He used a typewriter. The bloke is writing about computers and the internet, cyberspace, all this wrote on a manual typewriter, which I
probably with two fingers.
Probably with two fingers, yes. Quite possibly, as all the best people do.
Ignore this. It's a rug covering a hole.
Anyway, let's have a look at this game. So you're going to pick out three highlights.
Yes.
And one thing that doesn't quite work. So what are your three highlights first?
I think the archetype,
yeah,
the life path, and also the setting, actually. Even though, having said, it's not my favourite kind of setting, I think the setting to Cyberpunk Red is good and has a few features that make it perhaps maybe fix some of the things I don't like about that kind of cyberpunk setting. So there you go. They're the three things I like about it.
Excellent. So the archetype, so these are like the roles, aren't they? So it's a skill-based system, and they have roles which determine your levels of expertise. They really, as you say, archetypes, aren't they? Fairly standard to begin with.
Yeah, but they're quite good in that they do encapsulate the kind of setting quite well. I mean, you played like a graffiti artist, didn't you? Like an artist kind of character, and that worked quite well. I thought, kind of in other games, that kind of archetype might not work as well as it did in something like Cyberpunk.
Yeah, I think the archetype or the role was a rocker boy, but changed it. It's really a charisma-based archetype, charisma-based role. So superstar graffiti artist. And some of the others, I think they complement each other really well, the different archetypes. I think the prominence of the fixer's a good one, the one that manipulates objects, because it's a slightly more post-apocalyptic world, the version of Cyberpunk Red. It doesn't mean that finding technologies and repairing them and making them work is a key role within it. And I think all of the roles are well considered and bring you into that setting really well.
And I suppose the next thing, the life path thing, plays into that. They're kind of connected, aren't they? But there is when you create a character, there is a kind of life path thing, isn't there? Which again is perhaps nothing new. Lots of games have that. I think it's one of the best though that I've ever, when we roll characters, it's definitely one of the best life path creation pathways because it does, I think all of us, by the end of it, we started with nothing and we ended up with characters that did have a colourful, interesting backstory that you could kind of play on and use, and just made the character more interesting just through rolling dice. Like I say, a lot of games do that, but I think it's one of the best, certainly one of the better ones.
Yeah, I think it's one of the first ones to do it in the way that it does, because I mean, we talk about Traveller's life path, and I think as you've observed previously, it's not really a life path, it's more of a just how you acquire skills, but
yeah,
the way that this life path works, I think it was there right at the beginning, this idea of knitting your character into the world through the relationships that the character has, and because it's using archetypes, it just differentiates them a little bit more. Yeah. Done at random. Do you want to do one?
Yeah, go on, let's do one.
One.
Okay. It's good as well, because it I suppose part of it gives you a sense of the world as well that you're in.
Yeah.
Go on.
What do I need? You'll need a D10. It's a D10. It's a D10 based system. You only need D10s for most resolution rolls, and D6s for damage related activity, doesn't it? So go on, roll a D10.
Okay.
Ooh, so this is first your cultural origins.
One.
North American. So I'm not going to say it's boring, but it's not a great start, is it? Not a very colourful start.
What you know, for two people stuck in Bolton, it's quite exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess. Okay, what's your personality? What are you like? Roll a D10.
Here we go. Oh, it's a 6.
Stable and serious.
A stable and serious North American. Okay, go on.
Dress and personal style. Okay. A D10.
10.
Asia pop. Yeah, that's sure.
Oh, Asia pop. He's a serious and stable person who dresses more like a K-pop character.
At the weekend, you've got pink lycra on. Yeah. Let's see what your hairstyle.
I've given the game away then, haven't I? I didn't know there's rap people, but I know what a K-pop is. There you go. Give the game away then. I pretend I don't know about modern things, but I do.
roll a D10 to see your hairstyle.
Five. Six again. Six.
Striped. Yeah.
Okay.
And now you've got an affection you're never without. So roll a D10.
An affection I'm never without. 9.
Fingerless gloves. So what have we got so far? I've got a North American stable and serious Asia pop person with striped hair like a tiger gloves. And fingerless gloves.
Yeah. I think it's someone who takes the Asia pop fandom very seriously. That's the thing, isn't it? That's the thing. Takes it very, very seriously. Other people might laugh and say, look at this idiot. But he or she takes it very, that's the thing, take it very seriously.
Committed to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, let's see what your motivations are. So what do you value the most?
7.
7, love.
Ooh. Okay.
We're getting a real picture of this person.
Yeah.
Okay. How do you feel about most people? Give me a roll of 10.
2.
You stay neutral.
Standoffish. Unless they're a K-pop boy band, I'm standoffish.
I'm beginning to see this serious person, quite quiet, standing at the back of the K-pop concerts.
Yeah.
Okay, what do you value the most? Roll a D10.
2 again.
A brother or sister, and the possession, your most valued possession.
6.
6. A recording. Oh, got a rare recording.
A rare recording, yeah.
Signed by all the band, is it?
Yeah, it must be, mustn't it? Yeah.
Okay, let's see what your original family background is.
4.
Ah, you're part of a nomad pack.
No, okay.
If you want to do your childhood environment.
1.
1. You ran on the street with no adult supervision.
Well, yeah, I can see this kind of character. Asia pop was all they had.
All they had?
It's all they had. Quite so important to them.
Roll your family crisis.
Family crisis, 5.
Your family's vanished. You're the only remaining member.
Don't know where they've gone.
Don't know where they've gone. Don't again come from.
Don't know where they've gone. but I'm close to a brother or sister. I'm convinced my brother is a member of an age pop band.
And
but I can't prove it. But whenever I see them on a big screen in the street or something like that, I'm convinced that's a memory of my brother, the long lost brother.
And the key to it is that recording you've got.
Yeah.
There's a spoken word bit, isn't there, in the middle?
There's a spoken bit that sounds like it's a memory of his voice, you see. But because I'm on the street, there's no way I can get to contact these Asia pop people. They're so remote, aren't they? Superstars, got security around them and everything. How am I going to get in touch with them?
Let's see. Let's do a final one. This is your enemy, this. So this is who you do your beef with.
Okay. Four. Beef rap.
It's a childhood enemy. Let's see what wrong they've done. Okay. Well,
10.
And the setup is one of you set up the other for a crime that they didn't commit. So is that why you're on the run?
Yeah, that'd be it. That's why I'm on the street, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which makes it even more difficult to get in to meet the Asia pop band because you're a criminal, aren't you? You're wanted. So not only have they got security, they've got you're not just an ordinary fan, you're a wanted fan as well.
And I think that's how it works, and there's more development.
Yeah. Well, it's really good because you do, it's just like that, isn't it? That's completely at random, and you develop. Almost like a scenario in itself, that, isn't it? That you use that to build a scenario around.
I think why it works is because it is so detailed and it creates, as I say, weaves you into the world. Mm. It's good because I always find that these dark urban fantasy science fiction can be quite superficial, can't they? Particularly when you think of like the punkiness of it. I know your next thing is the setting, isn't it, itself that you've chosen. And I do think it does walk the line quite well in being something that is quite loose, but also quite rich in setting. Because that's what I always find with the films in this area, is that there's a risk that they're always slightly off.
Yeah, it's a strange one, isn't it? Because I suppose part of cyberpunk's shtick is that it's a dystopian future, isn't it? But sometimes everyone can appear a bit like a cardboard cutout, can't they? Like it's not really real at all. As if the world's never going to end up like this.
Well, it's like the idea of punks, isn't it? Whenever you see punks on these things, they always look like they've got leather pants on and white t-shirts. You know, like from Michael Jackson's Bad video.
Yeah, they look like about 45, don't they? Something like that. You think, well, what are you doing on the street with a sleeveless t-shirt and a baseball bat?
Yeah, who are these?
Like someone's dad. This would be, we've not got a job. But yeah, cyberpunk, it's a good job, I think, of developing a character quite quickly, quite easily, you know, and like that. It's just a few roles, and before you know it, you've got an interesting character from nothing, you know, from not from, oh, I've got an idea. You could have no idea whatsoever and roll, you know. And there are other games that do it, but I suppose was this one of the first that did it? Oh, it certainly didn't just quite a good job of it. And I suppose as well, it is sort of necessary, particularly for someone like me, because that kind of setting is not my go-to sort of setting. So when we started playing it, I was thinking, I don't really know what to play. I don't really know what kind of character to play really in it. You think of Netrunner, don't you? That's what you think of. Like I say, you think of Netrunner, whatever that means, or you think of like that punk kind of sleeveless t-shirt, back, baseball bat. That's it, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I ended up playing a cop, and I didn't really think of, I thought, well, I'll play a cop. And the backstory I got did give me something to work with. Cyberpunk Red does do a good job of giving you a lot of stuff that makes it easier for you to get into it, even if you're not quite into that sort of setting, I think.
And you've picked the setting itself, so Night City, as it's presented, not excessively full of lore.
No, it's not full of lore, and it's full of kind of interesting mega corporations and things like that. But I quite like the idea that it does something quite clever in that, because it's sort of post-apocalyptic, isn't it? It's like there's been this pocket nuclear weapon exploded or something.
Yeah. A combination of that, isn't it, and various climate conditions have transformed it from being the burning chrome to a slightly derelict place.
Yeah. But I quite like the idea that in the game, there are networks for netrunners to hack into, but they're all broken up, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not, you can't sit, weirdly, you can't do what hackers can do now, in that you can't sit at home and hack into the mega corporations' computers, because this slightly post-apocalyptic setting has broken down those networks, so they're all a bit broken, aren't they?
Yeah.
So you can hack into things. And we did this in Steve's game, didn't we? We hacked into things, but you had to get into the building to get into the network, which meant that you did need other player characters around you as a netrunner to get into the building and support you.
It's like protecting the wizard, I guess, isn't it?
I suppose. I mean, it does still have that problem that when the netrunner goes into the network, that is, as you said earlier, like a parallel universe and like a game in itself, isn't it? And it is problematic, I suppose, that it can, if you're not careful, it can leave the other players hanging around going, well, what are we doing? Why he does this?
It's very dangerous as well, isn't it? Because I remember Mark's brains being fried on a couple of occasions.
Well, his character.
Yeah.
I mean, he was shocked by the experience, but I don't think it was that bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was. Yeah, it's kind of a dangerous thing to do, isn't it? Because I think the opening scene, the opening adventure with Steve, the series of adventures that he ran for, was about a netrunner getting a brain fried, wasn't it? That was the beginnings of the adventure, was to find out what she'd encountered on this network and what had happened to her. So, yeah, it's quite a dangerous thing. I suppose it is, as you say, it is comparable to the wizard, isn't it? You're quite powerful in that you can go into networks and open doors and turn on lights and shut security systems down. But of course, there's a price to pay, isn't there? In that it's a very dangerous thing to do because you're going to encounter the security system. And in the game, the security systems are done in that kind of way of, or it's like a wolf or something. They're done in a, again, I conflate virtual reality with it, but they are like a virtual reality kind of thing, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. There are like wolves and monsters, things in the network security programs are manifest as things visualized in a kind of way, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, which is quite good. But as I say, I think the slight problem that if you're not careful, that can become like a bit of a side game, can't it?
What's the thing that you think could be better?
I think this is a common complaint, isn't it? Suppose there's a few too many skills.
Perhaps we should say something about how the resolution mechanic works, because you do have attributes and you have skills, and you can have a go at doing anything other than net running. I think all of the skills are available to everyone.
Yeah.
So if you haven't got the skill, then you just roll the base attribute, and it's a target number that you have to reach, adding those two things together plus a D10 roll.
There's criticals and fumbles, isn't there? So if you roll a one, don't you roll it again and take it off the result?
That's right, yeah. And if you roll a 10, you roll it again and add it on. So it becomes... Yeah.
And there are target numbers. There's target numbers that you need to beat, obviously. That's the idea, isn't it? So you could do a critical fail and potentially still succeed, can't you?
Yeah.
If you're really lucky, you know, roll a one and then you roll a one again. That'd be okay, wouldn't it? But yeah, that's how the fumbles and the criticals work.
Yeah. I think the use of the expression critical in that sense doesn't really work, because I don't know whether it's a holdover from previous editions, because it doesn't really have, other than it reduces your chance of doing what you're trying to do, it doesn't have any material effect on the outcome. It's nothing. It's just a bit of colour. There's no mechanical advantage to getting a critical success or a critical fail. It uses the language of critical injuries, and so that can sometimes get mixed up in your brain, I think. I don't know. That's feedback I'd give on it.
It's not the only game guilty of this, but I just think that sometimes there's a few too many skills.
I don't know whether it's not helped because there's a great character sheet, isn't there, on Roll20 that works really well. Yeah. But the skills are tabulated and some of the tabs are not intuitive, are they?
Yeah, that's true, actually. I mean, that, yeah. And in some ways, that's, I suppose that's a way of arguably judging a game sort of unfairly, isn't it? Because the character sheet is good in that it does lots for you. It works and everything. It's got all the information there. But as you say, because it's taught tabs and things, you can't see all the skills in front of you. So when someone says, oh, do this, you go, oh, which category is that under? Hang on a minute. Whereas if you had a character sheet, some alphabetical list, you'd just go, oh, well, there you go. That's that. I know where everything is. And it might not feel, to be fair, it might not feel like there are too many skills when you do it like that. But our experience of it is playing it online. And it does colour your experience of it.
Yeah.
Character sheet is a different thing.
I think we're also spoiled by Savage Worlds, which seems to have hit the sweet spot for a skills-based system in that they're broad enough to accommodate a whole range of activity. When they start getting granular, you just start rolling your eyes, don't you, trying to find.
And also the problem with having lots of skills like that, it's always the problem of, you know, that some skills are more useful than others. But then, of course, when you need that skill that's not used very often, nobody's got it. You have it because no one thinks to have it because there's no use. Yeah. So there are some kind of, I suppose it's kind of, I'd say not odd skills, but skills like, there are like dancing's on the skills.
Yeah.
So again, it's like my Age of Pop character, I suppose, would be good at dancing, wouldn't he or she? You know, that might be something they're good at. But would people put points into that? Maybe not. But then again, if dancing somehow became important.
I have a fondness for the resolution mechanic. I think it is one of those that's quite flexible to adopt because it's quite simple. Target number, D10 plus attributes and skills. Mm. You can sort of deal with any situation. You know, if you want to grab somebody, it's a simple opposed roll on that basis. So it does fit a lot of areas. And as I said, you are quite competent as characters when it comes to combat. So you can afford to take a few penalties to take a bit of a risk, and you can move and fire. And so it really gets into the spirit of the cyberpunk acrobatics, if you like, the bullet time type fighting.
Yeah, bullet ballet.
I quite enjoyed that aspect of it. I'd like to play more of it, I think. I've got the key rules here, as told to us by Ripper Jack. Number one rule, style over substance. Number two rule, attitude is everything. Three, live on the edge. Four, break the rules. See, when we work on our like anger type podcasts, I don't think we've quite achieved it. But I think
is this going to be like an offshoot podcast? The Dirk and Blythe's beef rap podcast. It's about us coming up with arguments that
we'll work on it. We'll work on it. Cheers, Blythe.
Goodbye.
The Save for App podcast covers old school gaming and the modern games inspired by them. Listen in to hear about games from the 70s and 80s as well as their modern descendants. You can download episodes wherever podcasts are found on iTunes, Google, and other fine podcast distributors. You should also check them out on saverhalf.com or email them at saverhalfpodcast@gmail.com.
I'll get me caught! Well, we're wandering towards the door as we're putting on our coats. We don't need our coats. It's quite warm today. But nevertheless, we've can't quite leave the table. We've got some closing time chatter. Blythe, what's on your mind at the moment?
Well, as you know, it was my birthday recently.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Happy birthday to Kylie as well. It's always
Well done, Kylie. Another year. Anyway, My daughter got me for, my daughter is a big Doctor Who fan, and I'm a big Doctor Who fan, and she got me the Doctor Who role-playing game, the new one, the second edition. They've done a new one. So we've played the original, haven't we? You ran some.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did like it. One of the reasons I didn't buy it was because I know myself too well, and they've done all those source books, haven't they, for every single Doctor. And I knew that if I bought it, I would end up buying all of them. Now the new one, you can use those for the new one, but the new one, they tweak the rules a bit, and they've done like two source books. One that's all the kind of all the old Doctors, you know, the pre-revival Doctors, and then another one which is all the kind of Christopher Eccleston onwards. And of course, when I got the rules, I bought both those. But it's quite a good game. It's a good game. It's all right. It's good. I thought it was good when we played it. It's kind of an interesting game in that. I mean, I have to say, it's. I never thought, because obviously on the front cover of the new edition, it's Jodie Whittaker. I never thought I'd have a role-playing game with Bradley Walsh on the front cover. 20 years ago, you said, you know what, one day you'll have a role-playing game. I'll have Bradley Walsh on the front cover. Get out of it. Why? How could that happen? What a possible set of circumstances could that happen? Well, it has. So there we go. But
it could be worse, of course. You could have had Bunny Langford and Ken Dodd on it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that is true. There are worse options, aren't there? That's very true.
It's a magnet for light entertainers in the UK, isn't it? Peter Kay.
Yeah.
Frank Skinner's been in it, hasn't he? Yeah. Frank Skinner's been in it.
So, yeah, there's quite a lot been in it. But trying to do a bit of sci-fi. Being in Doctor Who, it's like a badge of honour, isn't it?
Yeah.
There we go. No, it's a good game, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot to like about it. I'd be interested to see how it's changed from the previous edition, but I did like the initiative that had fighting as the last resort.
Yeah.
So the last thing that happens, because I think that emulates Doctor Who really well. So yeah, you do.
And they still have that. They still have that. Yeah, they have the talking, running, doing, then fighting. So if you were confronted with a Dalek, you if you want to talk to try and bamboozle the Daleks or run away, you can do that before they shoot at you, which is very Doctor Who. It's very Doctor Who. So it does a really good job of creating the sense of the TV show. But what's good about it as well is it's very flexible. Well, I mean, we talked about this, I think, in the last episode. We've talked about it before. The idea of these role-playing games based around a particular series or particular idea, like Alien or Blade Runner and that kind of thing, do have that problem that they're quite limited in what you can do. I mean, Star Wars is probably an example of one that's quite flexible, but a lot of games, very, very limited. And Doctor Who is surprisingly flexible. You know, you can do a lot with it. You know, you don't have to play the Doctor. You can play Time Agents. You can play some of the aliens. You can play a unit. There's lots of stuff you can do with it. And in an interesting game as well. It's got a nice, simple system, but also interesting because whilst there is fighting in it, you know, there are Daleks with death rays and Cybermen and all that kind of thing. There is fighting, but fighting isn't the focus of the game. So it's one of the only games where the player characters, generally speaking, are unarmoured. Right, the Doctor and his companions walk into these adventures and they're not armoured or they don't have weapons, do they? Which is quite unusual for a role-playing game, because most role-playing games obviously focus on, you know, get yourself a gun, get yourself a sword, get yourself a shield, do that kind of, you know, all that kind of thing. Even Call of Cthulhu, I put a revolver in your handbag. But the Doctor doesn't do that. And the game itself tries to discourage you from randomly killing. It says that's not what the Doctor does. That's not what he does. He tries to negotiate things. Yeah, you might have to blow up the Daleks' spaceship. But initially, you will try and negotiate with them. That's what he does.
Yeah.
And that's what he encourages you to do. And it has some quite nice rules around social conflicts. And it's got nice rules about running away as well, which is another big part of the program. Running away is a set of rules about that.
Well, I think it's got that scalability, hasn't it? So as you say, you can have a range of different adventures from the, because you can see it over a series of the Doctor Who, can't you? Some of them are cosmic in scale, some of them are very planet focused, and some of them are situational, just dealing with one idea. So I do like that element of it. The other bit is that it's familiar. It's like Star Wars in that you don't really need to know the lore to know the game. You can do this, you can play in the setting without having deep knowledge.
Exactly, yeah. And it's like a great kind of thing for one-shots at convention, because you can just present people with characters that they might be pre-gens, but they know who they are, don't they? They know what the monsters are. And also it's good because, again, you read those source books and every Doctor's a bit different. They're all a bit different. The storylines in those, for those Doctors, were a bit different. So I think where, you know, the Pertwee, where he's stuck on Earth, is very different from Tom Baker, where it's kind of a bit more gothic horror. So they're all kind of quite different. So you can also, again, they come back to that thing about flexibility. You can pick a particular Doctor and go, all right, well, this Doctor dealt with things that are a bit like this. Yes. So that's what I'm going
to
do.
You got that project that Clarke Kiha has engaged with UNIT. You don't need to have the Doctor in it at all. You just use assistants based in UNIT. And talk about that familiarity with setting and the bestiary. I played a con game. The Fall of Delta Green, John Lennon's Lost Weekend, where it interacts with, it's a proper mashup. The kind of stuff that 7 years ago I would turn my nose up, really. And when we played that game, everybody knew who Sontarians were. Everybody knew who the Rutons were and could replicate bodies. But when it got to the deep lore of the Beatles, like Magic Alex Mardis and his Nothing Box, that was actually a Sontarian device, people didn't know who Magic Alex was. I had to explain that.
They looked blankly at you. Go on, what's been on your mind? What's been on your mind lately?
I don't know if I mentioned this, but one of the projects I've got on the go at the moment is creating a scenario, convention scenario, from the Mean Arena, which appeared in 2000 AD, which is sort of a Roy the Rovers type story, where there was street football, which is a combination of American football and soccer, played in deserted streets in the near future. And I was a big fan of it back in the day when it was a comic strip, and there was part of it was on the pitch and part of it was like off pitch drama of rivalries and that kind of thing that was happening on there. And I've been trying to convert it. One of the puzzles I've got and I need help with is when it comes to a game within a game. So part of the fun of this will be to actually play over the 3-4 hours, and whilst there's all kind of backroom drama going on, you'll actually be participating in a game. The comic strip doesn't really tell you what the rules are. The rules are just implied.
No, it never did it? Yeah, they didn't ever really went into the rules, did it? It's just action-packed stuff, wasn't it? All right, I don't know what the rules are, if indeed there were any.
So that's the thoughts I'm having. Do you actually play the game, or do you just have it implied and have it abstracted, a bit like Mornington Crescent, where you have kind of an implication of the rules that might be there, but they don't really exist?
It's quite a tricky thing, isn't it? Because if you go down the road of creating the rules of the game, the sport, for example, if you play that out, you can quickly descend into it being like a board game rather than a role-playing game, can't you?
You did that, didn't you, in one of the traveler scenarios that we had, the Pirates of Drinex, where...
Yeah, you went like grab car racing, didn't you? And I came up with some rules for grab car racing. Yeah, that's right.
And that was quite exciting.
Yeah, the rules worked quite well with the levels of success and trying to slow down. I kind of came up with some rules about... You got points for going round the corners. The faster you went round the corners, you got points. But of course, it was more risky. That was the thing. It was more risky to do it. So you got points, and the points indicated how far ahead you were. So whoever got the most points was the fastest. That's how I did it. Rather than actually physically moving you around the board and moving your squares or something like that. It was based on, I think it was based on the pilot, the driver's skill and how successful they were offsetting it against a target number being more difficult, and they all got the most points at the end. But I suppose that was okay in that it was once, that it was like maybe an hour of our Pirates of Drinax, and that was okay. But with a convention game, I suppose, you've got to be careful, haven't you? Well, I say you've got to be careful. Maybe you don't have to be careful, but I suppose if it was me, I would be thinking, well, this is a role-playing game that people have signed up to. I don't want to sort of blindside them with something that essentially turns into a board game.
Yeah.
That's the problem. It's like, where's the role? Like, say, whether you... You got me thinking about it now. Whether you just imply these things so that you can concentrate on the backroom role-playing stuff, or whether if you come up with some set of rules and play out the matches, how do you incorporate role-playing into those matches so that the matches don't just become a 45-minute board?
Yeah.
Not a board game, but you know, like a different type of game.
I suppose the way that I'm tackling it is the choice of system. So I'm thinking of using Forged in the Dark, which is the system that Blades in the Dark is based on, and doing it in four quarters at different points of the town, different points of the city, and treating it like a heist.
Yeah.
And so roll to determine whether you start the quarter with the ball or needing to get the ball.
Mm.
And we just play that aspect out. And then where it's a downtime, there's downtime activity. That's like the backroom drama that's happening. And that may have an influence on the next quarter. The challenge is making it feel like it's a cohesive game that exists by giving the players just enough knowledge that they can get the sense that they're playing in a game within the game, but not getting too hung up with, right, what do I do? What do I have to do?
What are the
scoring rules? Yeah.
Yeah. The tactics and the rules of the game, which then make the one shot role playing session more like a different kind of game rather than a role playing game. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Work in progress, Blithey. That work in progress.
Mm. Yeah.
I might have to ask for some more input.
Although I suppose when you think about it, I suppose even in a normal role-playing game, a regular role-playing game, there are fights, aren't there?
Yeah.
I could argue fights are like a game within a game, aren't they?
Yeah.
So you've got like a lot of games will have rules for doing things, doing this, doing that, make a roll, do this, pick the lock, find the trap, all that kind of thing. And then when combat starts, there's like almost like a subset of rules that whilst they're very similar to the other rules, they are different. So, I mean, I think off the top of my head, that Doctor Who's like that. It has a resolution system for when you want to hack a computer or reprogram a Cyberman or do the roll and target number. But then the combat rules, although they are based, they are the same. There's a slight different subset of rules where it's contested roles and there's a turn order like that. Like you said, there's the talking, there's the running, there's the doing, there's the fighting, which of course in the general run of play, you don't do any of that. You do roll to see if you hide or whether you find something. Yeah. But the combat is in almost all games, you fight back. You can die for cover. You've got automatic fire. So there is that in all games, I suppose. There's like a subset of rules. So maybe what the way to think about it is, think about the games, the matches, like the fights.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like they're a combat of sorts that you're going into.
Yeah. As I say, work in progress.
Mm.
I'll have to contemplate over it. My beer's gone slightly warm now. We've had so much chat. I think
mine's gone. No, it's not gone warm. It's gone.
Well, until next time. See you later.
There isn't another bit.
Thanks to Alistair for adding Neuromancer to Appendix G. It's also a featured book in our science fiction season of novels in the book club. It meets mainly on the first Sunday of the month at 9:30 a.m. until 11 a.m. prompt. It's a gentle chat which manages to be both fun and informative. Check out thegrognardfiles.com for more details. We've also announced another online convention, this time on the 8th to the 10th of November 2024. Grogmeet-ish. It'll be on the weekend when we would normally have our meeting in Manchester. However, due to a couple of reasons, not least the MTV Awards being held in the city that weekend, we've moved actual Grogmeet to January 2025. Keep watching thegrognardfiles.com for more details. We've just had a big bill for the hosting costs, so thank you to the patrons who keep this thing of ours going with our tips in a tip jar each month over at Patreon. Thanks for listening. If you get a chance, please can you leave a 5-star review somewhere to help others find us? There hasn't been one for a while, so it'd be really encouraging and helpful if you could do one. Thank you. Now, we're hoping to get another one of these out soon, maybe another back-to-back. I think it's time we had another look at spring cleaning our shelves. Until then, adios, amigos.
Ooh, she's my massive
Euphoria. Them superpowers getting neutralized. I can only watch in silence. The famous actor we once knew is looking paranoid and now spiraling. You're moving just like a degenerate. Every antic is feeling distasteful. I calculate you're not as calculated. I can even predict your angle. Fabricate stories on the family front, cause you heard Mr. Morale. A pathetic master manipulator. I can smell the tails on you now. You're not a rap artist, you're a scam artist with the hopes of being accepted. Tommy Hilfiger stood out, but FUBU never had been your collection. I make music that electrify them. You make music that pacify them. I can double down on that line, but spare you this time. That's random acts of kindness. Know you're a master manipulator and habitual liar too. But don't tell no lie about me, and I won't tell truths about you.